Good morning, Raymond.
Hello.
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 Tra-la-la.
Tra-la-la. How are things going with you, sir?
Doing okay. How about you?
Good. I've sent you like 400 emails. You haven't replied to any of them this week.
I know. What a dick.
Like, I'm like, what's up with the daughter? What's going on with your snakes? Nothing.
Okay. Daughter, they've done tests, can't find anything, so just keeping an eye on it. You know how that is. They can't give me a definitive answer, so we'll just keep an eye.
Well, that sounds good, I guess. It's better than saying, hey, we've definitely found something bad. Any more snakes in the Harris household?
No, I think when I cut the head off that one, the reputation of Ray Kickass Harris was enhanced enough that they all...
Word spread.
That's right. Well, it probably has something to do with I took the snake head and I made a necklace out of it and walked around for around the yard a couple of days. So, you know, I'm not saying I'm badass, but, you know, I'm kind of badass.
Did you nail the head to the rostrum?
Yeah, actually, that's what I did. I nailed it to my back porch. See this? This could be you.
Yeah, this is what happens when you mess with Ray.
That's right. It almost made me wet myself. Almost.
I'm not exactly sure where that's going, but okay.
Yeah.
Are we recording? I guess we are, but just wanted to say, Ray, that as I've said in my emails to you in the last week or so, the show's been going nuts.
It's awesome.
It blew up finally in June. June. Yeah, blew up in June.
Yeah.
I think we went from, you know, 10,000 listeners to 100,000 listeners. I don't know. Don't quote me on those numbers.
I was trying to go, what? I'm going to quit my job. Anyway, so,
Thanks to everybody who's still listening, which isn't. Mike Ginnism from the United States, who says too much shtick.
You can never have.
I'm going to have to bail on this podcast. I love the subject, but there are too many yucks and jokes that distract from the subject. Here's a typical podcast. Cam. Hey, Ray. Ray. Yeah, Cam. Pull a Sulla. Ray. Wait. Cam. Well, we have 5 minutes left. Let's talk about maybe we should talk about Caesar. Oi, Ray.
Okay, where do I start? First of all, on you.
Hold on. He says he loves your Churchill, WW2 podcast. So, you know,
don't. Well, I think it's awesome.
Yeah.
I was just joking.
The rest of the reviews are great. We'll talk about them later, but that one amused me. So, let's get into it, Ray.
Let's do this.
Let's do episode 14 of the Life of Caesar podcast in the last episode.
Last time.
Yes. Last time on Life of Caesar.
Right.
The Helvetii got their collective butts kicked by Big Julie in his first real campaign as a governor. Proconsul, but also is he a proconsul?
Yeah. Yes, he is.
And also as a military leader, really his first big showdown was against the Helvetii. 300 and I think we said it's like 68,000 people, two-thirds of them, men, women, and children, dead on the battlefield. And quite a few Romans too, by the sounds of it, because he spent 3 days at one stage to tend to his wounded and bury his dead. So Caesar's starting to make a name for himself, both in Gaul and we assume back in Rome. He's going to be sending these stories. Quite possibly, the reason he wrote the commentarii in the first place is to send reports back to the Senate saying, "Check it out."
Check me out. Check. And not only that, but he also gets credit for it. This was not a planned campaign against the Helvetii. I mean, he had to wing it. And it was pretty impressive. The results were pretty impressive.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, you're right. He had to wing it. This wasn't something that had been in the planning for 2 years. He was just right. Like, I mean, as people remember from the beginning of last episode, he was still in Rome when the Helvetii started to move into the territory, and he got the call on the bat phone, and he was like, "Whoa, right. Okay, let's get out of here." Right. So, what now, right? What's going to happen next in the Caesar story? Where are we up to? What's the year?
All right, so we're still in the summer of, is it 87 BC? 87.
87?
Is it 87? I'm totally losing this. Is it 83?
83?
Where in the hell am I at? Wait, what podcast is this? Is Churchill in here? No, seriously, I am totally drawing a blank on the year right now, and I totally apologize, because there was one other thing I was wanting to make a point on before we jumped further, and I apologize for that. Where in the hell are we?
Well, right, we're
58. Okay, yeah. I'm dyslexic. The high fun summer of 58 BC. No, the one thing I wanted to
point out.
What?
Where did you come up with 83 BC?
If you take 58, you add it twice, you divide it by something. Fuck, I don't know. But anyway, so it's 50. It's the summer. It's the summer of 58.
It was
BC.
The summer of 58. Oh yeah.
Anyway,
you remember that song, don't you?
I will remember it for the rest of my life. Now I can tell you that. I don't know if you ran across this. I tried to do some research and I couldn't find it. Were the Helvetii as a tribe, as a coherent cultural force, were they pretty much wiped out after what Caesar had done to them? I couldn't find anything as far as any future that they had. And I think this is going to happen to other tribes as well, but I was just trying to confirm that one way or the other.
Yeah, I had actually researched that for the episode last week. Little mention of them in the histories. They apparently went back to Switzerland and invented Helvetica, the font.
But other than that.
I mean, you know, no, we generally we don't really know what happened to them.
Gotcha. Okay.
there's probably Swiss people listening to this going, "What are you talking about? We are here now. We're listening right here to the podcast.
I'm the great, 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 great." Well, you know what I'm saying. Yeah. So, So we apologize to you for that stupid question. Anyway, so as far as what happened next, I thought this was pretty entertaining. So, Caesar has this great victory, and then he starts getting complaints from a lot of other tribes in the area. That the German king Ariovistus has been raiding them, has been taking hostages, has been basically making himself a big pain on their side of the Rhine River, and all these different tribes are sending requests to Caesar for help, and they want to have a big parley about this whole thing. So Caesar is getting all these compliments, but at the same time he's getting a compliment. It's like, "Hey, can we meet because we want to talk about something?" So Caesar says, "Sure." So they all get together. And this I found hard to believe, but when they were talking to Caesar about all the different things that the Germans were doing to them, there was a lot of tearful demonstrations. There was a lot of tearful pleading to Caesar for help. And I'm just trying to picture these half-naked, whatever, savages, barbarians just in there crying in front of a Roman senator. That had to be a very surreal, weird experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and he wrote about a similar sort of incident when he was talking about the Helvetii. Like he is portraying the Gauls in his commentaries as this sort of, I don't know, weepy people who are like begging him for mercy and throwing themselves at his feet. Although he portrays Ariovistus, or as I like to call him, Arya Stark, a little bit differently in the commentaries here, but. Yeah, there's a lot of weeping, a lot of gnashing of teeth, which, I mean, I don't know. You've met French people. I mean, I guess they're a bit like that. The background.
I was just surprised. Yeah.
The background with Arya Stark is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, he was one of the first problems that Caesar was actually planning on dealing with when he took on his governorship. Because they had received word that he was causing problems in Gaul. But then the Helvetii thing happened, and Caesar needed to take care of that. Now he's coming back to Ariovista, right. Even though he's sort of saying, well, these people are coming and pleading with me. It was sort of one of the things he intended to do. But going back even further than that, Ariovistus is a friend to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime, I think about 58 BC, just before Caesar's governorship of Gaul, the Sequani and the Arverni, two Gaulish tribes, asked Ariovistus to come and help them in their war against the Aedui. People will remember the Sequani and the Aedui from the last episode. But Ariovistus was a friend to Rome. He had been declared a friend and, I think, king. He sort of received recognition several years earlier by the Senate, and Caesar was a big part of that. Caesar was a big part of declaring him king and friend to Rome. And one of the reasons that's interesting is because apparently from the Roman Senate perspective, if they acknowledged someone like Ariovistus, a German tribesman, as a friend to Rome, it kind of, in their eyes, it made him their vassal. It was like, well, look, we have acknowledged you, so therefore you kind of owe us.
And you exist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But as we'll see in this episode, Ariovistus didn't really see it that way.
Yeah, it doesn't matter that much to him. So what I thought was interesting, if everyone looks at a map of Gaul at the time, the two closest provinces that Caesar are in control of, that he's the governor of, are way down there. Like it's the trip you would take if you were walking from Rome to Spain. So he's way up here. He's much further north now, and you have all these different representatives complaining about Ariovistus, and they need Caesar's help. So in essence, what they are doing is asking Caesar to project Roman power or Caesar's personal power in the majority of Gaul. And what does Caesar do? He just looks at it and goes, yeah, I'll use my auctoritas. I'll take care of this. I will handle this for you. I mean, he didn't have to say no. Maybe he'd had to say yes politically, but technically he could have said no, because that was way beyond anywhere Roman province. So I just thought it was amazing that he would take that on himself, but I think he knew what he was doing.
Mm.
I think he wanted it the whole time, and he just had to, play it a certain way.
Of course. I mean, I think it's fairly easy to, based on everything that we know about Caesar up until this point, the debts, the need or the desire to be the big man in Rome, the need in that case to make a name for himself. He knows exactly what he's doing here. This is win a lot of battles, increase his renown, and make some bling, man, so he can pay off his debts and continue to bribe others.
And not only that, but just like every other facet in his life, he's probably thought this way out to the nth degree. So he knows what he's doing, but it has to be portrayed in a certain light. And he's doing a very good job of that, because he probably has spent a lot of time thinking exactly what he wanted to do.
Yeah. So the Gauls come to him and go, please, Mr. Caesar, will you help us with this nasty Ariovistus guy? And now we also have to remember that, Rome has a recent history with the Germans within living memory, the Timbri and the Teutones. Teutone. they had given the Germans a hard time. So the Germans, given the Romans a hard time. So, they've got a bit of track record with Germans. Even though they've just recently declared Ariovistus a friend, they probably, do want to keep an eye on the Germans.
Yeah.
So, Caesar says to the Gauls, no problems. Yep. He's the godfather. He goes, you come to me at this time. they went to him on the, luckily they approached him on the day of his daughter's wedding.
That's he's right.
Like, come to me on this day of my daughter's wedding. It's happy for me to grant you this favor. So he says, I'll take care of it. But
being
Caesar, You know, he sends envoys out to Ariovistus to say, look, let's sit down. Let's have a, what do you call it? What do you call it when they sit down? Let's have a meeting. No, there's a better word for that.
Face to face, a confab, a con, you know, who knows?
He said, let's FaceTime.
Yeah, let's work this out. Come on.
Let's sit down. Let's work it out like friends. You're a friend of Rome. We've declared you king and friend. Let's sit down. And Ariovistus, being a reasonable German, says
no.
He chops off one of the envoy's middle fingers and sends it back to him. Ariovistus goes, no, I don't think so. No. Now,
you come to me.
Now, let's stop a second and think about that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at this stage, Caesar's, as we've said before, just starting out. Ariovistus probably knows who he is. He knows he's, you know, one of the senator, ex-senators, ex-consul, now pro-consul. He probably knows he's not a man to be taken lightly, but at the same time, he's not the Caesar that we know and love. I mean, the next 10 years hadn't happened. So he's just like, but this is Rome. So forget Caesar. This is Rome. And Ariovistus is like, no, you want to talk, you come to me.
That's right.
I mean, there's a certain level of self-confidence in this guy. I like Ariovistus.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like, no, I'm the man. So you come to me.
Yeah. You want to talk? Fine. Well, why am I getting on a horse and riding for 10 days or 2 weeks or whatever it is? You want to talk? Fine. You come to me.
So Caesar is not a fool. He's not going to go up there by himself, and talk to this guy. So he says, look, so this is the way it is. You were made a friend during my consulship or before that. We acknowledged you. So leave the Aedui alone. Return their hostages. No more Germans coming across the Rhine. And if you don't adhere to all of this, I will have to take steps. And you don't want Caesar to take steps.
Yeah, I'm going to bring it on. And so Ariovistus, he says, look, dude. Oh, but Caesar also makes some other demands. And, Caesar says, look, I will come to you, but if I'm going to come to you, here's the deal. You can't bring any more Germans across the Rhine into Gaul. You've got to restore the hostages to the Aedui. Stop raiding and threatening them. You do all of these things, then, we're still going to be friends.
Right.
And Ariovistus sent him a reply saying, dude, who do you think you're talking to? Basically, that's was right. His response. He was like, look, you're a conqueror. I'm a conqueror. I don't see where you get the balls to tell me what to do. You go run your province, Transalpine Gaul. I'm running my province. By the way, I was invited here. They gave me land. This reminds me a lot of Napoleon's responses at different times, particularly when he moved into Spain. He was sort of invited by the royal family of Spain to go in, and then he was like, well, hold on, you invited me in here. I didn't just, walk through. So Ariovistus he's got a point, I think.
Yes, very valid point, yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, why should and here's the interesting thing. Caesar records all of this. He records all of Ariovistus's retorts in the commentaries. Which I found kind of interesting reading through him again last night. Like he's painting Ariovistus out to be a fairly reasonable, coherent guy. Like he's not demonizing him.
Right.
He's not saying this guy was a bloodthirsty monster of an invader. He wasn't saying he was Saddam Hussein or Hitler or Osama bin Laden. He was like, this guy had a fairly reasonable argument. And so think about that for a second. If Caesar's writing these to make himself look good, why would he paint Ariovistus in such a reasonable light, do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think to a large degree, and I'll be able to back this up later in this episode, I think to a large degree, Caesar was going to be as accurate as it could be. And again, if you paint the guy as a raving loon and you defeat him, but if he's this noble warrior and you defeat him later, I think that makes you look better. But at the end of the day, I think Caesar was going to tell as close to the truth as he possibly could as he saw it. And there was no reason to lie because it's going to be decided on the battlefield and not in the pages of his commentaries. That's my take on it.
Hmm. Good take.
Yeah. Can I give you the PS of Ariovistus's letter to Caesar when he replied to Caesar's request? You got to think it's something like this. We haven't lost a war since we crossed the Rhine and come over here. Obviously, Gaul is run by a bunch of nannies or Nancys, and if we do come to blows, we're probably going to kick your ass. Don't make me shove my sword someplace you'll regret. Sincerely, Ariovistus. I mean, his letter had to end somehow, something like that.
Actually, I've got it. I've got the line straight from the commentaries that I might read. Mm-hmm. So this is what Caesar wrote. This is what he said Ariovistus said. To this, Ariovistus replied that the right of war was that they who had conquered should govern those whom they had conquered in what manner they pleased. That in that way, the Roman people were wont to govern the nations which they had conquered, not according to the dictation of any other, but according to their own discretion. If he, for his part, did not dictate to the Roman people as to the manner in which they were to exercise their right, he ought not to be obstructed by the Roman people in his right. That the Adui, inasmuch as they had tried the fortune of war and had engaged in arms and had been conquered, had become tributaries to him. That Caesar was doing a great injustice in that by his arrival he was making his revenues less valuable to him. That he should not restore their hostages to the Adui, but should not make war wrongfully either upon them or their allies if they abided by that which had been agreed upon and paid their tribute annually. If they did not continue to do that, the Roman people's name of brothers would avail them naught. As to Caesar's threatening him, that he would not overlook the wrongs of the Adui, he said that no one had ever entered into a contest with him, i.e. Ariovistus, without utter ruin to himself, that Caesar might enter the lists when he chose. He would feel that what the invincible Germans, well trained as they were beyond all others to arms, who for 14 years had not been beneath a roof, could achieve by their valour. I love the balls of that. No one had ever entered into a contest with Ariovistus without utter ruin, and Caesar could join that list whenever he chose.
Yeah, go ahead, Caesar. Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Damn. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I'm a conqueror. You're a conqueror. You know how this goes. Piss off.
And we've been doing this for 14 years, bitch.
Yeah.
You just got here.
You just got it. You're the new guy.
Yeah, we've been doing this for 14 years. That's like, that reminded me of Alexander, you know, taking his guys out. I think they were out for about the same length of time, weren't they?
Yeah.
When they went out to Persia, they were gone for, you know, well over a decade.
Right.
These guys were just on campaign for 14 years.
Yeah, they can handle it. And you have to think about it. I mean, he's got to be thinking, who do you think you are, Pompey? Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah,
know,
yeah. But I would like to challenge. I don't know if that's the right word, but I would like to challenge our listeners as we go into this. This is something that I find very hard to do when I'm reading history. Is you have to remember to judge the actor's actions by the rules of the day. It's very hard for me to go, oh my God, how is that not barbaric? But you know, you have to consider everything in its context, and it will just make a lot more sense and be a lot less, I don't know, either gruesome or whatever, but these are people dealing with life the way it is at the time, you know, and that's just something to keep in mind.
Yeah. Another quote from Ariovistus, which I thought was kind of cool, that Caesar records. He says, the friendship of the Roman people ought to prove to him an ornament and a safeguard, not a detriment, and that he sought it with that expectation. But if through the Roman people the tribute was to be discontinued and those who surrendered to be seduced from him, he would renounce the friendship of the Roman people no less heartily than he had sought it.
Damn.
Again, I'm just fascinated, A, by Ariovistus's haughty demeanor in this, which I think is pretty cool. Look, I thought being friends with you guys was going to be a plus. If it's not, fine. Yeah. I'll just give it up, dude. Like, I don't need you. But B, also that Caesar records it this way. Like, again, he records it in a way that when you read it, you think, okay, well, Ariovistus has got a fair argument here. You know, he's making a lot of sense. But Caesar went to war with him anyway. As we'll see, that wasn't really his doing.
Right. So at the end of the day,
tells the story.
Exactly. So at the end of the day, Ariovistus can say all the nice, calm, normal things he can say, but at the end he says, no, we're not going to stop being who we are by the rules of conquest. So Caesar knows he's got to deal with this now. As you said, he planned on dealing with it before the Helvetii. So he this time he is very smart. He makes sure that his grain supply is well taken care of. He can't afford to have happen what happened before with the battling the Helvetii, and he sets out north to face the Germans, or at least to go make it clear to Ariovistus that he is very sincere in his demands for him to stop acting like a barbarian. So they start heading north. And
do you know where the word barbarian comes from?
No.
I was just reading this the other day.
Is that Barabbas? But I have no idea. No, I don't know.
No. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I thought it was it was, you know.
Please.
You know how I like to just go off on tangents.
Please.
It was a term that the Greeks came up for to describe anyone who wasn't Greek. And it was because the word baba, like a baby, babbles by saying baba. Right. Because they couldn't understand the dialects of the languages of these non-Greek people. So to them, it all just sounded like babble, baba. Right. And so consequently, they were barbarians because they babbled baba.
So the next time our listeners are at a party, they can, hey, did you know where the word barbarian come from? And score some major points with the people in the room.
That's what I do at parties all the time. This is why I never get invited to parties. Did you know?
Well, not re-invited. But anyway, so the Sequani, who kind of helped start all this by inviting the Germans over, they have a very well-designed, well-built, and well-stored fort in their area, and Caesar finds out that's where the Germans are heading. And I don't know how to pronounce it, obviously, but it's something like Vesontio or V-E-S-O-N-T-I-O, Vesontio. Are you laughing at me?
Vesontio. Oh, okay. I mean, right. How hard can that be, dude?
I mean, I don't know where the accent's at. I mean, I'm sure half of it is
Vesontio.
There we go.
Vesontio. Don't take pronunciation criticism from me, dude. Jesus.
No, of course not. So there's a race. Caesar and his men and Ariovistus and his men, they are going for this. Now, Caesar, as we have seen throughout his entire life, seems to be a vampire or something and doesn't need or whatever sleep. He marches his men night and day, and they just move like, and this will be one of the great, one of the reasons why Caesar was such a successful military commander is because.
Sorry, now we've just got this whole great idea for a new movie.
Oh, here we go.
Julius Caesar, vampire, going up against Abraham Lincoln, vampire hunter. Imagine that, Julius Caesar, vampire, like, and telling the whole story of Caesar. He's a vampire.
It would make more sense. But see, he would still be alive, alive by the time Lincoln comes along.
No, but see, they didn't stab him in the Senate.
Oh, just to the groin. No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
They were putting a stake through his heart. That's what was going on because Cicero and these guys, Brutus, found out he was a vampire.
Right. Okay. Ooh. So now I hope Roman history makes a lot more sense to everyone now. Caesar was a vampire. So anyway, so they're racing to this fort, and Caesar marches his troops night and day. And of course, being Caesar, his men get there first. They get inside the fort and they lock it all up. And of course, it has a lot of supplies, but it's not going to be enough supplies to last them all summer. And Caesar was moving so fast that he kind of left his supplies behind, which, again, this is very important to him because he's got thousands of men with him. So he's going to have to watch out for that. But he does beat Ariovistus and the Germans to the fort. And now it's time for Ariovistus to make the next move.
Yeah. So Ariovistus, you know, still hasn't met with Caesar, but hears that he's you know, his troops are getting close. So he sends Caesar a letter, sends him an email, and says, okay, all right, well, okay, so you're serious. I didn't think you would have the balls, but apparently you do. Apparently my threats and my warnings about the power of the Germans, didn't really take as seriously as I thought you would. So, you want to sit down? Okay, sure. I get it now. You want to sit down? We'll sit down. So they do sit down. They sit down and they have a meeting.
But can I bring something up before the meeting?
Yeah.
Please. Okay. Now, I couldn't find much on this, and maybe, I don't know if you read over this or whatever, if any of our listeners could shed any light on this. I found this very, very interesting because it doesn't fit in the story of Caesar at all. So because they had been doing so many forced marches, by the time they get there, the men are wiped out. They're safe in the fort, but they're wiped out. So while they're setting up negotiations between Caesar and Ariovistus, the men are resting, obviously. But word spreads throughout the camp, and it's almost like rumors. And it's like, okay, well, I heard Germans are really tall. They're really big men, and they value courage above everything else, and they're really good fighters, and they're not afraid of anything. And so this fear, this pessimism spreads throughout Caesar's army. But not only that, it's not the common soldier at first. It's his officers. It's his centurions. And it's like, I mean, just Caesar just has to emanate confidence all the time. How could he not? But I just don't get how this kind of sprung up, unless it was really good in counterintelligence work by the Germans. Who knows? But anyway, so in the next couple of days, there are people coming up to Caesar going, oh, I forgot something in Rome. I forgot my car keys. I forgot to turn off the toaster or whatever. And there's a lot of people asking to leave or begging to get away. And Caesar realizes he has to nip this in the bud before he deals with Ariovistus. So he gathers all his centurions and all the other important officers. And there's like just under 400 men, and they're all having this meeting. And I thought this was really interesting. And Cameron, feel free to add anything at any time, but Caesar just doesn't go in there and just start yelling at them about being a bunch of Nancy boys. He is very methodical. He turns from the warrior to the lawyer, and he treats it like it's a case that he has to win. He has to put this case before his men, and he says to them, okay, point one, I am the appropriately legal appointed consul, the governor of this province, and this is my responsibility, so don't ever question my right to do whatever I have to do. Two, there might not be a war. The Germans may have been, you know, we're talking, we're being nasty to each other, but at the end of the day, they might adhere to what I have told him to do. We don't know that yet. Three, if fighting does break out, it's not like you said, it's not like the Romans haven't kicked German butt before. Gaius Marius did it with the Cimbri and the Teutonese, so we can kick German ass if we have to. Okay. Four, Ariovistus, hello, he outsmarted Eduai. We're not Eduai, we're fucking Romans. No one's going to outsmart us. I got this. And five, I am not worried at all about the men not obeying me. You shouldn't be worried. But if you're going to walk around nervous and questioning everything, then the men are going to sense that, and this whole thing is going to fall apart and we're going to die. Don't question me. And he really goes on about the 10th Legion, about how loyal they are. And the word gets back to the 10th Legion, and they really buck up and they really shine
go ahead. He says to the rest of the commanders, but look, that's fine. If you don't want to come, I'll go by myself and I'll just take the 10th Legion. We don't need you.
That's right. Me and the 10th will take on the Germans all by ourselves.
That's fine.
Get stuffed. Yeah.
Yeah, you just stay here and we'll go take care of it. Now, of course, the 10th Legion, the 10th Legion just go, and the rest of the commanders come back and go, Hold on.
Yeah,
No. We weren't saying we didn't want to go. No, we want to go. Oh, do we want to go? We can't wait to go. I don't know where you got this idea from that we didn't want to go. I mean, why are we talking about this?
Yeah, let's go. But Caesar was very smart, even though he did that, and even though he won the day, and he won even more closely brought the troops to him as far as loyalty and thinking of him as a man of Caesar and not just a Roman representative. He listened to some of their complaints because they were about to march through some hills to get to the Germans, and they were bitching about they didn't want to walk through any more hills. They had been doing forced marches and they were exhausted. So Caesar takes a slightly longer route, but it's more flat land, open area. And so even though he's chiding his men, he's got one ear open to their complaints and he's listening and he's making very practical, frugal decisions. And he's got a very balanced view about this so far. So they start marching out, and that's when they're getting closer and closer to the German camp that's further up north.
Yeah. And again, whilst we have to remember that this is Caesar's own writing about what an eloquent speech he gave and what a cunning manipulator of his own troops he is. I do think there's a good lesson in there about, like, he could have basically said, listen, I'm the boss and you do what I say or I'll have you executed. But he didn't. He called on their pride and their vanity and also, you know, sort of bolstering his own argument with some logic. But basically at the end of the day, he said, look, that's all right. If you're too scared, I'll just go do it myself.
And he shamed them.
I mean, and these were guys who, I don't know, they were just, you know, they were kind of as close to professional soldiers, I guess, as you had in those days. They didn't want to be didn't want people laughing about them. I mean, again, reminds me of Napoleon, where in the speeches he would give, which, and I think he learned a lot from Caesar, he would talk about history will remember the valiant day that we went and did this thing that we're about to do, and they will sing songs about your victories and write stories. And,
right.
You know, calling upon the pride and the vanity of and the ego of troops has obviously worked since Caesar's day. So anyway, they said, okay, and he got over that little hurdle.
Exactly. And you have to remember a lot.
Just again, interesting that Caesar writes in his own version of events that his troops didn't have a lot of faith in him and that they were starting to, you know, cause problems. And, you know, it's like a CEO today writing, you know, a report, in the annual report after the AGM going, you know what, yeah, my staff didn't really trust me. they kept saying they didn't like my ideas, they didn't like my strategies, but I talked them through it.
Yeah.
I mean, that that takes a certain amount of confidence and, you know.
Cojones, And the other part of this is that you have to think a lot of these soldiers, not the officers, but a lot of these soldiers are probably guys in their 20s. And if there's one way to manipulate a guy in his 20s, it's his pride. It's his manliness. And he, you know, Caesar jerked on that chain and they responded. And I just thought it was fucking brilliant. Sorry, no pun intended. Sorry. And, so it worked. So anyway, so the Romans march, they keep marching, but these are not forced marches. And they march for about a week. And then they find out they're about 24 miles away from the German camps. So now Ariovistus is realizing that Caesar is this close to him with his army, sends out envoys and he says, let's talk. But because Ariovistus knows his own heart and he doesn't trust Caesar and he feels that Caesar doesn't trust him, it takes them 5 days to negotiate exactly how these two men are going to meet up. And they finally figured out they're going to bring a bunch of guys, but when it comes to the actual entourage, only horsemen, no infantry, only horsemen. And of course, the Germans are much better horsemen than what the Romans are. But Caesar doesn't trust his German allies this much. So he literally takes men from the 10th Legion, puts them on a horse, even though they probably don't know which end of the horse is which, and they ride with them. And I think they get something like 200 paces. Caesar and Ariovistus is like 200 paces away from each other. And then only those two men with 10 horsemen with them actually keep going forward. And that's when they start talking. But it just took them 5 days to work out the details because there is simply no amount of real trust between these two men.
Yeah. And so they sit down and they have their tete-a-tete. And Ariovistus says, look, you say you're a friend, but you've brought an army here to destroy me. And Caesar says, well, you know what? I told you what I had to do. We want you. We don't want it. We want it, don't want to go to war. We don't want this. Just give me everything that I want and we don't have to go to war. Ariovistus, in this, in this sit-down, he makes an interesting comment. He talks about that if he did kill Caesar, he says something like, I don't know if the actual words in front of me, but he says something like, look, I've got friends in Rome, I've got friends in the Senate, and they've told me that if I kill you, a lot of people back in Rome will be very happy.
That's right. He'll be very popular all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, again, so obviously, yeah, he's like, got a network in Rome.
And again, this is Caesar recorded this in his commentaries.
Yeah,
like
astounding.
This isn't somebody else's version of this is Caesar's version of events. Like, he wrote down that Ariovistus told him that if he was to be killed, there would be a lot of happy people back in Rome.
Like, yeah, which is why the commentaries more or less are considered, you know, something you can go by, because he does write this stuff. He's not leaving out the embarrassing parts.
And imagine this document being read back in Rome. Like,
right.
I think we said a couple of episodes ago, we don't exactly know when he wrote them. If he wrote them after each year as they happened, or if he sat down at the end of his governorship and wrote them all in one hit, which would seem like a big exercise because he had a lot of other stuff going on. But so we don't know if it happened like so. But either way, he was alive, very much alive, when these were published.
Yes.
Imagine like people reading that going, ooh, Caesar knows that there's a lot of people in Rome who want him dead. Maybe that wasn't that unusual, though. I mean, we already know there was a lot of rivalry, a lot of tension between the elite of Rome. So maybe that wasn't as big of a shock as it seems to us in this day and age. I mean, I'm just trying to think of, I don't know, an American politician or an Australian politician writing in the memoirs, look, I know there's a lot of people in Washington who want me dead or in Canberra. A lot of people want me dead. I know that. But, you know, take your best shot.
But, I mean, but to say that to another guy's face and you both got armies, I don't care the context of the time. That just takes a certain amount of balls to do that kind of thing. You know, I could win a lot of friends in Rome if I killed you right now. What do you think about that? But, but I just thought it was interesting. So Ariovistus, again, makes some very good points. He goes, he's looking around. He goes, do you see Transalpine Gaul? I don't see Transalpine Gaul. You know why? This isn't fucking Altrans. Why are you here? What are you doing? So this is north. This, if anything, this is my province because I want it with my own blood, my men's blood and whatnot. And this is my area. Get the hell out of here. Until you leave, Caesar, I am going to think of you as an enemy. And again, he said that. What the fuck?
When did you become Samuel L. Jackson, man? Like, you've said fuck about 15 times in this episode today.
Sorry.
You're like, you're channeling Sam Jackson from Pulp Fiction. When did this happen? When did you become a black pimp, dude?
Most people don't know this, but I am a black pimp. I use another photo for my website. But anyway, I'm trying not to be a stiff.
Ray from the Hood.
That's right.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
You're trying to have a personality. That's what it is.
I am trying.
It's just
very
it's Samuel
hard.
Jackson's personality that you've
well,
you
I don't
decided,
have one of my own.
You decided to try that one on. Yeah.
I stole his. So at the end of the day, Ariovistus says, look, like I told you before, you're a conqueror. I'm a conqueror. You know what I'm doing. You get this. Piss off, or I'm going to run you through.
And Caesar was about to try yet again to calmly convince him that this was not the course of action that he should take when, according to Caesar's version of events, some of Ariovistus' troops started throwing javelins and stones at Caesar's mounted legionaries. So Caesar was like, what? Stones? No, what? No one throws stones at Romans, so they called the whole thing off. Caesar got up, walked out, dropped the mic, slammed the door, and went back, and he and his troops departed. So that was kind of it.
Well,
not kind of it, because then after a couple of days, Ariovistus sent him a note saying, look, sorry about that. If we'd known that throwing rocks was a bad thing in Rome and javelins, we wouldn't have done it. No one told us. How are we supposed to know? Where we come from in Germany, we always throw rocks and javelins at our friends.
Yeah.
So he said, look, let's have another sit down. Caesar doesn't sit down with him, but what he does do is he sends a couple of envoys, Valerius Procillus and Caius Matius. He sends them, and Caius Matius is a merchant who had actually visited Ariovistus and been treated well by him in the past. Valerius Procillus was a friend of Caesar's, longtime friend. So he sends them instead as his envoys. Unfortunately, they rock up, and Ariovistus denounces them as spies. Throws them into jail. Basically, puts them in chains straight away.
Right. Yeah. And then not only that, but the same day he does that, Caesar gets word that there are more German raids around them, and that they're getting closer, and that Ariovistus had set up a camp on a high hill, only 6 miles from the Roman camp. So Ariovistus has made his position quite clear. Yeah. He's coming, and there's going to be a war.
Yeah, and also the when he set up his troops, he also led his army out and marched past where Caesar was camped to establish a base a couple of miles behind the Romans to block Caesar's supply lines.
Yes.
So it's all going down now.
That's right. So I thought this was interesting. So they come closer. They set up a sub base south of Caesar, or at least not north of Caesar, to cut off the supply lines. And so what does Caesar do? He's thinking, you want war? You got war. So for the next 5 days, Caesar marches his men out of their camp. They line up, waiting for the Germans to come out and to commence battle. But the Germans don't do that. There's a couple of skirmishes. It's probably mostly cavalry. But for the next 5 days, Caesar is ready to have his battle, because he's also got to worry about his supplies, about food. But the Germans don't take the bite, and Caesar's got to do something, because his supplies are dwindling fast. These men eat a lot of food, obviously, and he's got to force the issue somehow very quickly.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, what does he do?
Well, I thought this was interesting. So everybody, knows what the face of a clock looks like. So if you picture a clock, picture the main Roman fort at 12 o'clock. The Germans have their camp roughly at 3 o'clock. And what Caesar's going to do is he's going to march out all of his men in three lines heading south. And they march out until they're pretty much parallel with the German camp, and they stop. And then they all turn and face the German camp. So while the first two lines are sitting there, maybe having skirmishes with the Germans or trying to be imposing, the third Roman line furthest away from the German camp, they start building a smaller Roman camp. It's going to be really small. It's only going to house two legions. But because it's in that area south of his main camp, it will help protect the supplies as they are coming up to Caesar. He'll be able to project power from that smaller camp. And because these are Roman engineers, this camp is literally built within hours. It's a real camp. It's got the pits. It's got the walls. It's got everything, but it's built within hours. While the first two lines were engaging or taunting the Germans, once the sub fort is built, and this is built about 6 o'clock. So you got 12 o'clock main camp, 3 o'clock German camp, 6 o'clock the smaller Roman camp. Once it's built, two legions go inside of there. The rest of the Romans back, not really retreat, but they go back up and they get into the camp. And now the Germans realize that they were able to outwit him. Caesar's going to get his supplies. So now he does not have to force the issue. Now he can take his time and think this out and wait to see what the Germans are going to do.
Now, I just want to think about this in a little bit more detail. How many, do you remember how many people were in a Roman legion?
Was it just under 5,000?
Yeah, it's about four to 6,000. We normally say about 5,000. Yeah. So he built this fort, and two legions went into the fort. Right. 10,000 men, and you say they built the camp in a couple of hours?
Hours, while the other ones were, Yeah, it's pretty, but that's what they did. They literally built camps at the end of each day. Maybe not this impressive one, but they just had it down to a science. They cut the trees. They knew what they were doing. And this camp just rose up in a matter of hours. And that's just another reason why the Romans kicked ass for so many years.
How do you build? I mean, I don't know what a camp involved, but obviously, I mean, it was enough to sort of protect the legions while they defended the supply lines. So I imagine like a lot of walls.
You get your walls. I don't know if there'd towers, be towers, like, maybe.
Yeah, probably not. You know, no houses or anything like that.
Right.
Yeah, some basic defenses. I mean, I think about it. You ever play Age of Empires?
I've seen it.
My kids and I used to play Age of Empires a lot. And, you know, if you went to a new territory, that'd be the first thing you do is set up some walls and a couple of defensive towers just to, you know, protect your people while you started to do some stuff in case anyone came along. So, but they're able to set up a big, I mean, so, but to house 10,000 people, it's going to be a pretty big area. Right. You've got to think it's got to be, what, a couple of square miles probably at least?
Something. I don't know, but yeah, that's a lot of people,
and that's a lot of walls, a lot of trees to build a lot of walls and towers. I mean, that's an astounding, it's an astounding feat of engineering for 58 BC, right, or wherever we are.
And it's going to work because later on that fort is attacked and it does hold off the Germans. So it wasn't just this rinky dink affair. It was a tried and true method that the Romans had.
So. Caesar, a couple of these, we assume, skirmishes that happened between the Germans and the Romans around about this time, Caesar got some prisoners, and he personally interrogated the prisoners and asked them, you know, okay, well, what's going on? Ariovistus has the high ground. Why hasn't he attacked?
Yeah.
Because Caesar didn't want to attack because Ariovistus had the high ground, so he's waiting. And it's not happening. Exactly. Days and days and days have gone past. And the prisoners tell him that Arius Stark was reluctant to engage because his diviners, his women that you know, were reading the signs for him, like Ray's snakes in last week's episodes that were obviously prophesizing the fact that Ray was going to turn into Samuel L. Jackson this week. That was the warning.
That's right. Now I know.
They were telling Ariovistus he could only win if he waited until the full moon.
Right.
So he is waiting for a full moon before he can attack. So this information gets into Caesar's hands. And he's like, really? Seriously? Cool.
So can I bring up 2 points real quick? One, if you know this, Cameron, or if any of our listeners do, we just kind of skimmed across it real quick. So there were some prisoners. Caesar questioned them. I really couldn't tell. I couldn't get any kind of information about. Was it just a conversation? Were there any hot pokers? Was it were they roughed up? Because these are German warriors, you know. I really don't know the answer to that, and I apologize. I wish I did, but if anybody knows anything about that, as far as Roman tactics or strategies to gather information from people, or maybe in this specific instance, it'd be great to hear from you. But the other thing is, and I'm sure you're going to bring this up, Cameron, so I won't ruin it for you, but here's Caesar, the Pontifex Maximus, who, as far as I can tell, does not mention pre-battle omens at all out of all the battles he's going to have over the next 10 years. And here are the Germans not doing anything because their women diviners say, got to wait for a full moon. I mean, that's just got to be militarily unsound in the extreme, you know?
Yeah, Caesar was a practical pope.
Yeah.
He was the Pope of Rome, but he's like, gods, sure. I think, you know, we kind of suspect that, you know, the Roman attitude towards the gods at this stage was... Yeah, look, it was tradition, I think, more than anything else.
Perfunctory, maybe.
Is that a word?
Yes.
Is that a word in Virginia? Perfunctory.
You know what? You're about to hear another word. But anyway, go look it up. No, but as real as Caesar has been with his writing, as far as we know, as correct as Caesar has been with his writing, he has not mentioned, and he will not go on to mention any pre-battle omens that he takes before, because he's a very practical soldier. And I think that says a lot about him and about his belief, or excuse me, the lack thereof, of the gods, because he doesn't mention.
Not just him. I don't think, I mean, we haven't heard any mention in any of the other battles that Pompey or Marius or Sulla, there's no mention of any of them, you know, looking for omens or going and consulting the oracle of Delphi or anything for signs, right?
That's a good point. That's very the only time they do it is when the new consoles come on their first day and they slaughter the bull and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but that again, that's tradition and showmanship more than anything else. And I just wanted to bring that up.
And when Caesar was consul, his offsider, Bibulus. Yeah. Bibulus. Say, sorry, you can't have the meeting today. Saw a bad omen. Sorry.
Sorry.
I mean, just
something else with your bull.
Which was obviously, you know, political theater and machinations to stop Caesar from being able to get anything done.
Yeah.
So I don't think the Romans at this stage, you know, take the superstitious stuff very seriously at all. But the Germans do, and it's going to bite them on the ass, on the German ass. And there's nothing worse than biting German ass. I'm not sure if you've ever bitten a German.
Well, I'm married to a German, so
that's
I do it all the time.
But do you bite her? I wasn't sure.
You know what? Let's not go into who bit who or who slapped who. But anyway, so Caesar knows that the Germans are not going to come out. And I just love this. What he does is the next day he brings his troops out like he had been bringing them out for the last couple of days. The Germans ignore him. But then he starts slowly marching his troops closer and closer.
They're on the hill. The Germans go, we got the high ground. I mean, no one in their right mind is going to march on us when we got the high ground. And he just does.
And he finally gets so close that it's actually embarrassing. It's humiliating for the Germans to be hiding. And the Romans are like, here we are. Come on out. Let's play. Let's do this. And the Germans are like, okay, woman, I know what you said about the full moon. The heck with that. My manhood is being questioned right now. So Ariovistus brings out his troops and they all line up and Caesar's going to get the battle that he wants.
And the other interesting thing about this is, according to Caesar's version, the Germans' wives and women and prostitutes, all of the women in the camp, jump up on these wagons that they've been traveling on and start screaming and cheering on their menfolk and telling them to protect them from slavery at the hands of the enemy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure Caesar had women in his entourage, but no, I don't think the Roman troops needed the women to urge them on. I think it was, they were professionals and just Caesar's dismissal of them for not being brave enough was probably enough to motivate them. But the Germans say, all the women, all these German women, it's a bit like an opera. So there's all these German women up there singing soprano, save us from the Romans. So battle breaks out.
And that was interesting. Normally they taunt each other. You throw some javelins, you get all worked up, and then you run. That, for whatever reason, that did not happen. They just kind of went at each other. But I think it's interesting to note that the Romans, in typical fashion, they have their three lines with a third line in reserve. You've got some cavalry on each end facing the Germans, who were pretty much broken into their seven, I guess the word is tribes, I don't know, but seven different groups of Germans with cavalry on each end. And so they tear into each other, and Caesar is on the right-hand side. To Caesar's way of thinking, and I don't know how he knew this, maybe you know, Cameron, but to him it looked like that was the weaker side of the German line, the German left, the Roman right, and so he puts himself on the far right, and on the far left is Crassus. His good friend's son, Crassus, is on that end, and he's in charge of the cavalry over there. So they engage, they're fighting, they're pretty much checking each other, no one's winning or losing, but then the side that Caesar's on, the German side that he's facing, starts to crumble, but his left with Crassus starts to crumble. But Crassus uses his authority to bring the third line over to stabilize the Roman left. So the Roman left was faltering. It's now restored. Everything's fine. But the German left, the Roman right, crumbles, and Caesar just pushes and pushes and pushes, and it breaks. And pretty soon it's just a cascading tidal wave event, and the entire German line breaks, and they all just start running past their women, past their carts, and they're just heading east as fast as they can, and the Romans just give chase. And of course, the Romans on horses are going to catch up to these people, and they're going to be pretty brutal because Caesar wants this over with, and Caesar himself was leading the charge, and he was pretty brutal as well, swinging his sword at the fleeing Germans.
And that's it. It's pretty much over. The Germans are defeated. Interestingly, though, Ariovistus gets away.
Yes. son of a bitch. Yes, and, but he gets away.
And is never heard from again. That's the last mention of him in history, at least, you know, the history that is available to us. Maybe there was stuff about him that has disappeared into the sands of time. But a couple of his wives and one of his daughters were killed in the action.
Yeah.
Another daughter was captured. Also, much to Caesar's delight, the his friend Valerius Priscillus and the merchant Matthias, who were sent as the envoys and were arrested, they were found and were unharmed and were rescued.
Yes.
But interestingly, though, I think Priscillus tells Caesar that three times the Germans had asked their diviners, their prophets, the women who told them not to fight until it was a full moon, whether or not he should be burnt to death.
Right.
And thrice he had been saved by lot. So they had, you know, cut open the stomach of a goat or done whatever they did to divine the will of the gods and said, no, don't burn him to death yet.
Yeah.
So imagine that, man. Like, imagine how relieved this guy is going to be.
Yeah.
Now, a couple of things that, I mean, that's basically it. I mean, we don't have a big battle story here. Caesar doesn't really write much about the battle more than what you've said. And, of course, his is the only account. The interesting thing, though, I read somewhere, somebody picked up, is that when you look at the commentaries, Caesar spends way more pages talking about the negotiations with Ariovistus than he does the battle itself.
Right.
Now, again, that's, you have to wonder why. That's pretty interesting. What's he trying, you know, what's he trying to convey here? The medium is the message in some ways. Is he trying to portray himself at this stage as somebody who's going to go to extreme lengths to avoid this war? And if so, why? Now, well, you mentioned before that a number of his troops didn't want to go to fight with the Germans. They were, according to Caesar, they were scared. Some historians have suggested that perhaps the troops, and by historians I mean like some people that wrote, you know, within a century after Caesar, Dio Cassius and people like that, that it might have been because they thought Caesar was just fighting these wars for personal profit. And they were like, you know, why do we have to put ourselves in harm's way for personal profit? I mean, this guy's got a legitimate reason to be where he is. And Caesar in the commentaries has now gone to extreme lengths to make it look like he spent an inordinate amount of time and effort and energy to avoid war with Ariovistus through negotiations, which broke down through no fault of Caesar's, just because Ariovistus was like, hell no, and threw rocks at him and arrested his envoys. And finally, like, enough's enough. Caesar had to protect his envoys for a start, who were arrested, but also protect the name of Rome, the pride of Rome, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that's why he's spent so much time and energy covering the negotiations and the commentaries, or do you have another analysis?
No, I think you're onto something there. When most of your story is about the negotiations and very little detail the battle is covered, he's trying to skew the perception because, again, he knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to have a series of glorious wars so he could outshine Pompey, make a ton of cash, become the first man in Rome. But he has to perceive himself. He has to be perceived as being forced into battle. It was beyond his control, and he was just reacting to others' aggressions. I think he knew exactly he was doing, and he did it pretty well. He did it pretty well.
So here's the lesson, boys and girls.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you hear political or military leaders justifying their acts of war by saying, oh, well, we had to, we were given no choice,
right,
just remember what Uncle Cameron and Uncle Ray telling you,
Take it. Yep.
Yeah. This has been going on for a long time. You know.
Right.
This is what military and political leaders do. They normally have one reason to want to go to war. In Caesar's case, money. Usually, money mm-hmm. is a good reason. But that's not how they portray it to the people. Oh, well, we tried to avoid it. We did everything we possibly could. We sent the United Nations in and we did. But look, our hands were forced. We had to go to war. Okay. This is a tried and true tactic for justifying war. Goes way back to our man Big Julie. Probably goes back way further mm-hmm. than Big Julie.
Yeah,
you know, goes back to the Iliad. Well, we didn't want to go and fight the Trojans, but, you know, they took Helen.
Yeah.
You know, when they took Helen, we had to go and rescue Helen. She was the most beautiful woman in the whole world. Yeah,
exactly. So take everything with a grain of salt. And to back up our idea, that winter of 58, 57 BC, they go into their winter quarters. Caesar goes back down to Transpine Alco.
Cisalpine Gaul.
Cisalpine Gaul. Okay, so he goes down there, but the troops are in their winter quarters in the Sequani fort in that area there. And Caesar totally illegally raises two more legions, the 11th. Is it the 11th? No, it's the 13th and the 14th.
Yeah, he's already got the 11th and the 12th.
Yeah, it's the 13th and the 14th. He's paying for it out of money that he got from Rome. So the Senate did not vote on this. The Senate did not directly provide money for this. So he raises two more legions and he trains his men very, very hard over the winter because he's getting ready to go even deeper into Gaul.
And as I'm sure you can tell, boys and girls, that is Uncle Ray's... We're at the end, voice. before we do that,
yeah,
got any toga pictures, Ray?
I don't have any. No,
me either. No toga pictures, which is very disappointing.
Yeah. I did have one gentleman, and I can't remember his name. I apologize. I'll put it on the Facebook page later. But he has ordered four mugs.
Whoa!
And he obviously is a crazy Aussie. And anyway, so I've got to ship out four mugs. So thank you very much for the order. I will. So I'll say a big thank you on Facebook and on the next episode. So he's going to give them out as gifts because obviously they're valuable, and he's trying to impress people. You know. So
I'll be getting those. Thank you, sir. Whoever you are.
Yeah.
Quick read of reviews. You can turn off now if you don't like listening to the reviews. But, you know, what's your problem? Have a bit of fun with us. Like, you know, enjoy the fact that people write us reviews. We've already read Mike Jinsum. Toga up from Australia. I came, I saw, I will hopefully get a mug. 5 stars. If you're invited to wear a toga on a podcast, then it is exemplary of the superior quality of the podcast. I don't think exemplary means what you think it means, toga up. But anyway, we'll take it. Cameron and Ray host the Togalicious Mint Quality Podcast, with which my only qualm is that I have to wait for episodes to be realized. Released might have worked better there, but anyway, unlike their other fine works on Napoleon and World War II, the podcast is more fun than a wine-soaked session at the Lupana. But of course, if you aren't a fan of fun, humor, Australians or Americans, then you probably won't share this opinion. Also, if Ray or the Podfather happen to read this, then I will send in my toga picture, but it won't be until my toga-themed 21st eventuates. Cheers from Sydney, Australia. Well, thank you, Toga Up. That's an excellent, if slightly weirdly worded, review in iTunes. And congratulations on your 21st.
Yeah.
Nice to know that there are some, you know, young people in the audience.
And young, intelligent people.
Yes. And with a good sense of humor. Right. Respect from DK from Australia. Agent provocateur and voice of wisdom. Combine for an unsanitized interpretation of an epic historical tale. A masterly display that balances the digressions that add color and movement to the main theme with a well-researched running sheet that brings the story back on track and focused. To those who say, I could have done that, let's see you do it. Five stars, gentlemen. I would love to share a stogie and a scotch with either of you if I am in Brisbane or Virginia, or either of you are in Melbourne, Australia. Wow, DK, that is that is a review that I'm going to print out and hang on. Not sure which one of us is the agent provocateur and which is the voice of wisdom.
What do we do when the what do we do when the reviews actually sound better than the podcast? I'm starting to get nervous now.
Well, we just stop doing it. We'll read the reviews. Okay. That's
there
all
we go.
Which people have already suggested might be what we're doing. Well, I am in Melbourne usually about once a year, DK. So email me your deets and we can head on down to Baranow's for a stogie. Nice little cigar lounge in Melbourne, Ray, that I'll have to take you to if you ever come over this part of the world. Wal Baranow owns it. Good bloke, Wal, friend of mine. Seth Jordan, Keth, C-E-T-H. How do you pronounce C-E-T? Is it Seth? I've only ever seen Seth with the C. Is it Keth? Is it short for something? Catheter? I don't know. From the United States, five stars. I love this podcast. I've gotten so much done around the house this summer listening to you guys. This makes the place look nice and the wife happy. I do have a question about a phrase Cameron often uses. What does straight from the gecko mean? This must be some Aussie phrase I'm unfamiliar with. Do I get a coffee mug if I only insult one of the hosts? Straight from the gecko.
Straight.
Oh, no. Straight from the get go.
Go.
Get.
It's that outrageous fake accent that you use.
G-E-T. G-O. Two words.
Yes,
straight
space,
from,
space T-O.
Straight from the get-go. Do you, is that right. not used in America, Ray, that phrase?
Yeah. No. Yeah. And there is the word get-go as well. So,
well, we have geckos in the house.
Yeah. So exactly.
But
so
straight from the get-go means straight from the beginning. Straight, you know, right out the gate.
From the start. Exactly.
Mr. Jordan.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Love your work. And good show from Piano Hack from the United States. This show is entertaining. Only four stars, though, so obviously not entertaining enough. Nothing too serious, very lighthearted.
Ouch! Two stars for you, two stars for me. Yeah.
And then on the Twitters, I haven't done a review of the Facebook reviews, but I liked this one on the Twitter the other day, just yesterday, I think, from Drew. Drew C. Stone, at Drew C. Stone, thank you for making Life of Caesar such a great podcast. Can't wait for the next episode. And also, before that, LJW, whose Twitter ID is very cunningly LJW68082307, because it rolls off the tongue. My fave podcast after History of World War II, of course.
Of course.
You don't get a coffee mug for, say, second best. Get a World War II coffee mug. Yeah. Hit up the host of the World War II podcast for a World War II coffee mug. Do you have World War II podcast coffee mugs?
I have Churchill and FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt mugs.
Oh, do you know what my son's official name is now? Fox Dunaway Riley, FDR.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, okay. His mother, you know, actually gave him a full name last week.
Yes, finally.
This week. So who wins? I mean, I'm thinking Agent Provocateur and Voice of Wisdom. It was hard to beat, although Toga Rupp from Australia was also pretty good. But I know you got to pick between the two, Ray. I can't do it. They're both Aussies too, so I'm obviously biased.
Yeah.
I think if Toga Rupp had sent a Toga picture instead of using his 21st, her 21st, as an excuse, you know, might have got the pip on DK.
Right.
But
Which one was first and which one was second? That's how I remember it.
Well, the Toga one was first. The Agent Provocateur was second.
Okay, let's do the Agent Provocateur.
I mean, my that only concern with Agent Provocateur is that this person is far too intelligent to be listening to this podcast.
Yes, but then there's a quandary because they commented on the podcast, so. So how about this? How about if they both write to me at lifeofcaesarpodcast@gmail.com, I will send them both a mug.
Or half a mug each.
Yes, I will break it and I'll use my sword. I will cut it in half. This will work out perfectly. And I will send them each in half. Yes, like a half of a heart.
Okay. Well, the Toga thing obviously isn't working. We need a new competition. We need something new to get people excited.
How about the wet toga contest? sorry.
That'll get us excited, but.
I already am. Anyway, yes, we need something else. Maybe our listeners would like to help, unless you have an idea, Cameron.
No, I don't. No.
Okay. So once again, we have let you down.
You could send them the head of all the snakes that you kill.
Well, yeah, but I'm saving them up to make a shirt for myself. But anyway, yeah, if you listeners have an idea of any kind of contest or any kind of interactive thing, that we'd really like to hear that. Yeah, just let us know, and you know, let us know what you'd like to hear, and maybe we can incorporate it.
I also want to give a shout out to my friend Darren in Australia. Darren was Skyping me about something the other day, Darren Bostock, and he said he's loving the show. Darren's an old Napoleon listener. I think he might be a World War II listener as well. Loving the show and wanted to give me money.
He's the one. I'm sorry. Shut up, Cameron. He's the one who's buying the four mugs. That's who it was when you said it. He's the one buying the four mugs.
Of course he is.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Darren.
That's good man, Darren.
He told me not to give you cash, but to take your half of the four mug money and turn it into cigars.
There you go. And of course, you weren't even going to mention that until I raised his name. Well, no, you were just going to keep the money. I tell him, don't send me money because it's not fair to Ray, so he sends you money instead. That's
fair. Everybody, anyway. That's fair. That's what you do.
Thank you, Darren. Good man. all right. Well, that's the show, folks. Thanks for listening. If you have any ideas for a competition that we can run or something you'd like to get in terms of bling, mate, if you have an idea for a design of a T-shirt or a coffee mug, you know, let us know. We're all about engaging with the peeps. Ray and I, we were talking off air last time about, you know, doing a tour, a Life of Caesar trip to Rome.
Yes, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, so if you'd be interested in something like that, let us know at some stage in the future.
Maybe something for next year.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, there you go. Okay. That's it. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Cameron. That was all I had.